The Tom Woods Show, episode 956.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you gun owners out there, if you're looking for ammunition at a decent price, or you've had trouble finding certain calibers in stock, well, AmmoSeek is going to solve your problems. Check them out at AmmoSeek.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. What books should we be reading? What are the classics? Not even necessarily the classics, I would say. What are just the books that, if you read them, you'd learn an awful lot that would help you understand the world better and that would buttress your arguments and fill out your knowledge? That's what I'm asking David Gordon today, and David's just ridiculously knowledgeable. If you ever have a chance to meet him in person, you'll see what I mean. Just ask him anything in the world, and he knows the answer. He's absolutely amazing. He holds a PhD in intellectual history from UCLA. He's the author of many books, among them The Essential Rothbard, and he is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute. David, welcome back to the show.
Oh, hi, Tom. Glad to be back on the show.
I don't know why I'm interviewing all these Mises people when I'm going to see you all next week and I could do it in person. But anyway, here I am doing it. There's no rhyme or reason to what I do around here. But I had a request. I was asking people, I want to talk to David and I've got some possible ideas, but what would you like to hear me talk about with him? And they said, given that you have written so many book reviews and you're such a careful book reviewer, and in general, you've just read so widely, what if we asked him about some of his favorite books or his best books, you know, the best books for us to read, and particularly books that are not ridiculously academic? So I just asked you like an hour and a half ago, all right, scrap our original topic, and instead I want you to do this. And I know that David Gordon just rolls with the punches, that that's no problem for his brain. So let's dive in. I don't know how many you have in mind. Give me a sense of how many you have so I can pace us here.
Oh, well, maybe about 4 or 5.
All right, so we'll have a good discussion about each one. And I don't know what they are, and I don't even know if I've read them. So this will just be fun to see what happens. All right, are these your most recommended books? Are they your favorite books? How would you categorize them?
Well, I would say they're books that I like a lot and also ones I think would be fairly easy for most people to read and I think would give a very good understanding of what the subject is. They're important subjects, important books on important subjects that I like and are also fairly straightforward, easy to read. I mean, they're not children's books. I mean, certainly lay people could read them without any trouble.
Okay, so go ahead and give me your first one.
Oh, well, one I was thinking, you know, a lot of people find Hayek's book, Road to Serfdom, 1944, very hard to read. And they'll say, oh, this is supposed to be one of the great, and it is one of the great classics, attacking planning. But then they pick it up and they find it very, very difficult. Now, there was another book that came out in the same year, 1944, which I think is at least as insightful, called The Road Ahead by John T. Flynn. And Flynn was a great American publicist, and he had been kind of an old-style liberal who became very upset with the New Deal of Roosevelt, and he had an analysis of the New Deal and similar legislation as leading to fascism in that it would be kind of a government control of the economy. And in order for the government to keep getting people to pay taxes and to support the program, they would embark on what he called military Keynesianism. They would have military projects and adventurism abroad in order to get people to acquiesce in having to pay for all these programs. I think that the book is very insightful. If you read it, it gives not only an analysis of the American economy and political scene at the time, and you can foresee developments that took place many years later, but also gives very good analysis of Italian fascism and discusses developments in Germany. So I think if you read that, it gives you a very good background understanding a lot of the events that are taking place. Today we can grasp the essentials of the economy and the political development.
Okay, so tell everybody the title again.
It's The Road Ahead. It's written by John T. Flynn.
Okay, so why would you, I'm just curious, why would you choose that one over The Roosevelt Myth, his more or less his biography of FDR?
Well, I think in The Roosevelt Myth is an extremely good book also. I certainly recommend that. But as you say, that's really a biography of Roosevelt giving an account, and of course goes into all the New Deal program. But this is more of a Road Ahead is a more theoretical book in that it's giving an analysis of fascism and showing the relation between New Deal programs and fascism. I mean, certainly, why not read the Roosevelt Myth as well? But I think The Road Ahead gives you sort of a more picture that you'll be able, I mean, if you read Roosevelt Myth, you know, you'll know a lot about Roosevelt, but you might not be able to apply all the criticism he makes of Roosevelt to contemporary development. Read The Road Ahead, I think you'll be able to do that. Also, it's shorter than The Roosevelt Myth.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is. But, you know, I never actually got to it. I read Roosevelt Myth, and I never got to The Road Ahead. Now, The Road Ahead is out of print, so but you can read it at the Mises Institute.
Oh yes.
Because they have a PDF.
Yes, they have so many things available. Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that's one.
Okay, so we're going to put that on the list. I'm going to put all these books at tomwoods.com/956 for episode 956. So I'm going to link to, for anybody who would like to get a physical copy, there are some used ones on Amazon that are quite inexpensive. But there's also a PDF from the Mises Institute to keep this thing alive. So you know what? Maybe when I'm there, maybe I'll read it myself. So let's see. So this would have been, this is, yeah, what is the, when does this book come out?
I think 1944.
Okay, yeah, so it is
same year
around the same
Hyatt.
Time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so it is that year, yeah. Okay, yeah, so it's also valuable because it gives you a sense of what some of the thinkers in our broad tradition were thinking and saying in those days and what they were expecting to happen. That's also just a useful historical document as a primary source in a way in and of itself. All right, so let's go on to the next one. Oh, by the way, you know what, given that we have a little time, can you say something about who John T. Flynn was? Because he began by writing for the New Republic magazine.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, he had he was in his earlier time, he was considered someone on the left. He had done investigations of corruption in business, and he was considered a liberal by the standards of a New Republic. But he was, by the standards of the time when he wrote for the New Republic, but he was someone who was opposed to intervention in foreign wars. And when he was a liberal, what he was a leftist, what he was principally interested in was corruption in business. But he didn't like, which when the New Deal came into power, he didn't like that the government was assuming control. This wasn't the sort of liberalism he favored. He was someone who favored individual freedom, and he was very angry that he thought that the New Deal had betrayed the liberalism he was interested in and supported. And Roosevelt took his criticism very personally. I think there's a letter that Roosevelt wrote to the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine when he urging them not to publish an article by Flynn, that he thought that Flynn had been very unfair in criticizing him. And then Flynn he was a leader of the America First Committee, which was opposed to American intervention in World War II. I think he was the head of the New York chapter, and he became very active in that activity. And then he also, during the war, he moved largely, it was not the way the parties had moved. It wasn't altogether a movement on his part, but simply the way the other parties were situated. He was considered more conservative, and he wrote books on the communist infiltration of the State Department. He had one called The Lattimore Story on Owen Lattimore. So he was very interested in communist activities in the U.S., and he wrote on that. And then after the war, he maintained his non-interventionist position. The National Review, which was established by William Buckley, wouldn't take his articles criticizing foreign intervention in the Cold War, even though he was by that time considered one of the leading conservatives in the U.S. He had a very popular radio show, but he was frozen out because of his continued support for non-intervention.
All right, let's go on to whatever your next book is.
Well, when we consider non-intervention, one book I like very much on origins of the First World War, you know, you find a lot of historians, and not just people who were libertarian, but even mainstream historians will say that the First World War was really the turning point, that things became very different after the First World War. It was really a disaster. And I think one of the best books on the First World War is Genesis of the World War by Harry Elmer Barnes. And it came out originally in 1926, but I recommend the 1928 edition as the revised edition is the best one. And what Barnes did, he was part of a group of historians who were called revisionists. He was the most prominent publicist. He was a newspaper columnist, he was a public speaker as well. That they challenged the view which was dominant in World War I during America's entry into the war, that Germany and Germany's allies bore exclusive responsibility for the coming of World War I. And they were called revisionists because they wanted to revise Article 231, the Treaty of Versailles, which blamed Germany exclusively for the war. So what Barnes argued was that there was actually a divided responsibility for the war, and he was inclined to emphasize that both France and Russia were willing to risk war in order to secure certain territorial changes in Europe. In the case of France, they wanted to regain the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, which had been surrendered to Germany after the Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71. And Russia wanted to gain control of the Straits of Constantinople. So Barnes, in his work, is a very well-written book. He stressed sort of the French president, Raymond Poincaré, and the Russian ambassador to France, Alexander Volsky, were very eager to risk war in order to promote French and Russian interests. So I think the book has held up very well after all these years. There's been an enormous number of books on World War I origins, some very recent that are good, like The Sleepwalkers by Christopher Clark. But this book is written in a very punchy style, and it gives you a good sense of how people in the 1920s were reacting against American participation in the war. I think it holds up pretty well. My friend Paul Gottfried, whom I know you know very well also, thinks very highly of the book. And I think this is one, if you read this, you'll understand a lot about World War I origins.
Okay. All right. That's very good. Of course, I'm also, even though it's not exclusively about origins, only partially, mm-hmm. of course, I know you and I are also partial to Hunt Tooley's book, The Western Front, although
does
it have a new title now?
I don't know that. It probably does. Yeah, I think he did a revised edition. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he's up with all the Hunt Tooley's very good to read because he's a specialist in this period of history, and he knows all the latest stuff, and he has a very revisionist point of view. He's very sympathetic to libertarianism, so I certainly would recommend him.
And I just checked his new edition, which I've interviewed him about, and I had just forgotten. It's actually called now The Great War, which is actually a better title, because his other book was not just about the Western Front. So it's called The Great War, Western Front and Home Front. So I'll link to that as one of the ones that we just happened to mention in the episode. All right, let's go on to book number three then.
Oh, well, this one is one of my favorites by Murray Rothbard called power and market. And you can read this. It's included in the edition of Man, Economy, and State published by the Mises Institute, but you can get it separately. I mean, that many people don't feel like reading a 1,000-page book. So, I mean, I think it's very good if you can do that. But if you read Power and Market separately, what Rothbard does in the book, he gives a brilliant criticism of all the major arguments for interference with the free economy. And he goes through them. He has a classification scheme, and he goes through them very systematically and comes through with all sorts of new arguments that you won't find anywhere else, or at least I'm not familiar with them. For example, when he's talking about democracy, he mentions an argument that many people advance in favor of democracy, which is something like this. If political regimes ultimately depend on popular support, if enough people don't like the government or really angry, they don't want to obey the government anymore, then the government can't survive. So if we have a situation where most people don't like the government and want to revolt against it, then unless we have some peaceful means of changing government, there's going to be violent revolution, and that's undesirable. So the argument for democracy is, if we can have elections where the government can be changed, then we can obviate the need for violent revolution, because then people can just vote the government out of the next election. So Murray Rothbard is very, very good at coming up with all sorts of counter arguments and counter examples of things. So he said, well, if we take this argument seriously, then why shouldn't we restrict the vote to, say, people of military age who are able to fight? I mean, old people like me shouldn't have the vote because we couldn't do anything in a revolutionary struggle, or disabled people shouldn't be able to vote. Why don't we restrict the vote just to those who are able to fight? It's a point I don't think anyone else has raised, but that would be the sort of thing he could just come up with if he just had all sorts of new points and everything. So I think if you read Power and Market also, in addition to the topics covered, you'll get a very good sense of what Murray Rothbard was like in conversation as a person. You'll see how he just had one argument after another, and he knew all the relevant literature that he could bring to bear on the topic. So I think this book would give you a very good sense of Murray Rothbard.
I read that book long before I read Man, Economy, and State, so I agree with you that it's good for people to read if they're not planning to read the whole thing. And of course, I don't know if everybody knows this, but the history of that book is that it was initially included in Rothbard's great treatise, Man, Economy, and State, and the publisher evidently thought it was a bit too radical and left it out. And so he later published it as Power and Market, I think, in 1970. But then when the Mises Institute published a scholar's edition of Man, Economy, and State, they published it the way Rothbard intended it, which was to include Power and Market with it. Now, of course, the first chapter of Power and Market is called, it's cold water right in your face, because it's called Defense Services on the Free Market. That is some cold water right in the face, but very, very interesting book. And Jeff Herbiner, who's the economics department chairman at Grove City College, tells me that he uses Power and Market for his public finance course. Imagine that, how great that course must be. All right, we'll get back to books in just a minute after we thank our sponsor. Folks, here's yet another reason that the internet is the most glorious thing in the history of the world. Check out AmmoSeek.com. Here is where you can quickly find ammunition, guns, magazines, and reloading components at the very best prices. It's a search engine. It lists over 350 different calibers, over 100 online retailers, adding new retailers constantly, and it only lists products that are in stock and ready for purchase. So, in other words, get a load of this. You can search by caliber, brand, grain weight, casing type, keywords, and more. You can save customized searches for later quick retrieval. You can set price alerts to receive an email or a text message when a product becomes available at a price you specify. You can also write and read retailer ratings and reviews. Seriously, why would you not use this service? Absolutely unbelievable, yet another miracle of the internet age. The website is amoseek.com. That's AMMOSEEK.com. All right, David, we've got two more books coming from you. Let's hear what the fourth one is.
Well, one I very much recommend is a collection of essays by Ludwig von Mises called Planning for Freedom. Now, many people, when they hear Mises was the greatest 20th century economist, the greatest had to be Austrian, so they'll reach for his most important book, which is Human Action. And then they start reading it and they aren't able to follow it. The first, say, 140 pages of Human Action have some rather complicated philosophical stuff. So then they put the book down and say, oh, well, you know, I can't read this. I'm personally glad that Mises wrote that chapter because that's what keeps me in business. And so they get me to lecture on the Mises Institute on that part of the book. So I'm glad he wrote it. But people find that very hard. So if you look at Planning for Freedom, it includes some essays that would be of interest to professional economists like Profit and Loss. But what you have here is a collection of essays that Mises intended for a popular audience. For example, he has essays critical of Keynesianism, like one he has, Stones into Bread, the Keynesian Miracle, and where he compares the Keynesian system where you can spend your way into prosperity with the biblical miracle of someone turning stones into bread. You know, I mean, he's saying that the Keynesian system really isn't, is just something absurd, not that that it's just something that people are imagining. You can just have some kind of magic formula to promote prosperity. But he emphasized again and again, the only way to promote prosperity is through increasing investment, because investment will raise productivity, and the wages, how much money people earn, depend on how much they're producing. What an employer, say, will pay a worker will depend on the value of what the worker's product is to him. So the more tools, the better capital equipment the worker has available, the higher his value of his product. So if you have more investment, the more investment you have, and this will promote wealth and prosperity. So the most important thing is to encourage investment. And you don't want to put bars to investment, like having interference with the free market. You also get, of course, Mises' characteristic theme that the free market is a system, what he calls mass production for the masses, and it will produce whatever it is that people want. And that it's, in this sense, it's the system really based on popular control of production, because it's people's decisions, what their dollar votes, determining what to produce.
I think I'm going to add to this one, if I may, The Mises Reader, edited by Sean Rittenour, that came out, I think, early last year, that I like very much because it's a great collection of Mises' writings, and it's not overwhelming like some of Mises' work, and it's not too simple like you know, a few of his essays maybe might be. Like, what is it called? What is that book called? It's a little book of essays, and it's something for today and tomorrow.
Oh, you know the book I'm talking about? Yes, I think so. Something like Economic Policy.
Thoughts for today and tomorrow. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I thought that was way, way too simple. So I think he really maintains a nice balance in The Mises Reader. So we'll link to Planning for Freedom and The Mises Reader also at tomwoods.com/956. All right, so what is book number five?
Let me see. Well, I think one I like, it's a bit more difficult than the ones we've talked about so far, but I think it's within the range of most people. It's called The New Science of Politics by Eric Voegelin. it's maybe a bit, it is a little bit more difficult, but I don't think it's too bad. Now, Voegelin had been a student of Mises. He was in the famous Mises seminar. And what Voegelin does was give an analysis of modern political movements, including fascism and communism, as forms of a Christian heresy called Gnosticism, where the Gnostics were people who claimed that they had a kind of secret knowledge of how the world was going, and that the world was going to end, and the people who had had this superior knowledge would then establish a better world. It'd be kind of an apocalyptic struggle, and a new world would come in. You might think, well, what do these religious categories have to do with contemporary politics? And I think Voegelin shows very well that by treating fascism and communism as political movements, I mean, as religious movements, you can understand what they're doing. He applies this also to not just to fascism and communism, but to certain types of liberalism in the 19th century. Voegelin was an extremely learned person. I remember when I was working on my PhD dissertation at UCLA, which was on the 16th century French political philosopher Jean Bodin, I visited Voegelin, who was at Hoover Library at Stanford, and he showed me he had a copy of the 1598 edition of a book that Bodin had written. He just took it off his shelf and showed it to me. So I think he gives you a very good account of political movements of the time. And he really shows you how to do intellectual history in a very good way. And he wasn't completely a classical liberal himself, but I mean, he had been, a student of Mises, and he and Hayek were friends. So I think he was quite familiar with the free market. But what he really does in the book, which I think would supplement the John T. Flynn book that I mentioned, he gives you more of the non-economic background of the 20th century political movement. If you read that book, you'll understand how certain political movements secularized religious categories. You understand, if you read that, why many people who support, say, communism or socialism, you'll find they're really immune to argument. If somebody says, well, look, Mises has shown in the socialist calculation argument, socialism can't work, so how can you still support it? They'll just ignore that because they're really dominated by a religion, just to say. If someone holds certain religious beliefs, it's unlikely you're going to be able to get them to acknowledge counter arguments to their religion. It become for these people a religion. Of course, there's nothing wrong with religion as long as it is something really coming from God. But if you try to secularize religious categories and apply them to something that's completely mundane, then you're going to get into big trouble. You know, of course, people used to make jokes. Voegelin used the phrase to immanentize the eschaton.
I was about to use that phrase myself.
Yes. So, you know, meaning the eschaton is sort of the last thing, and immanentize is to put into the world. So that you wouldn't be considering the transcendent, above the world or supernatural, as you would just be taking it as if it's something within the world. So there used to be funny slogans like, don't let them immanentize the eschaton. Or I think somebody had a t-shirt.
Yeah, and Buckley used to just say, in fact, I think Young Americans for Freedom back in Buckley's day, even used that temporarily as a slogan, don't immanentize the eschaton, which is just great. I mean, no one even knows what they're talking about, but I would love to be in a group that used that as a phrase. So basically, don't take concepts that are supposed to apply to another world and try to secularize them and make them organizing principles for the world that we live in, because it's going to be catastrophic and because we can't have conversations with you because everything is religious and therefore non-negotiable.
Yes, yes, that's it. That's it exactly.
Now, let me ask you a totally unrelated question before we wrap up for today. Given that you included a Rothbard book on this list, I feel at liberty to ask you this. I've been hearing for years people who maybe had falling outs with Rothbard or just never liked him to begin with. What they say is, yeah, he may have done some good scholarly work, but man, was he mean. If he didn't like your position on a scholarly question, he would just be vicious and brutal, and he made alliances and then switched them and then dropped people and added people, and he was a mean guy. And you knew him personally for a long time, and he was extremely fond of you and had tremendous respect for you. So I know you knew him as well as anybody knew him. What is your reaction to that claim?
Well, you see, it's not true at all. I mean, he was very, very friendly to people. I mean, I think those people tend to be upset with is that Murray had very strong views of his own. And if they wanted Murray to adopt, in many cases, wanted Murray to adopt their positions, and he wouldn't do it, so they'd get upset about it. Now, it is true that you had a view that Murray didn't like, and he gave you what he thought was wrong with it. He wouldn't like it if you kept insisting, you know, especially in political text, he kept insisting on what you wanted. I mean, he would tell you what he thought was right. He liked academic debates, but I mean, when it was matters of political strategy, he had his views on things that you can understand he wouldn't like it if you just kept going on and on. I mean, say if someone said to you, knowing your views, something like, oh, I think, the way Pope Francis is running the church is really great. And you said, no, you don't think so. And the person just kept going on and on about how great Pope Francis was. You probably would get sick of it after a while. So I think it's just like that with him. He wouldn't like it if people just kept insisting on something that he opposed. And unfortunately, many libertarians are just like that, that they think they know the truth and they're going to instruct Rothbard on what's right. And they didn't realize he was much smarter than they were, and he'd heard all the objections they had, and he was ready to... But if you were willing to learn from him, he was extremely friendly. If you talked to him, he'd be laughing a lot of the time. He'd always have funny remarks and jokes about things. And he kept up with a tremendous range of subjects that he liked to talk about. So the people who say that are not ones who knew him well. In many cases... See, as you know, there was a big split with Rothbard and Charles Koch when the Cato Institute. And as you know, the Koch Foundation, various foundations, have invested an enormous amount of money in supporting various libertarian scholars and others. So a lot of people who get money from Koch will be very critical of Rothbard, I think, because Koch is still very anti-Rothbard in his view. So I think, this is imputing bad motives to people, but I think in many cases there are people who criticize Rothbard or want to stay on the Koch payroll, so they want to keep criticizing Rothbard. But I can tell you, and I know... other people who know Rothbard well, like Joe Salerno, he will tell you he's an extremely nice person, easy to get along with. I mean, he was very much like an old-style professor who just knew everything. People would say similar things. People said that about Mises, that he was dogmatic, hard to get along with. And then people who know me will say, no, no, that's not right at all. He was very friendly.
All right. Well, I wanted to get your thoughts on that. I know, of course, what Lou has to say on it, and I've talked to Joe about it, and I have my suspicions as to why people spread this idea about Rothbard, and I don't think it's because they're after the truth. I think, well, anyway, I don't want to speculate out loud, but I have my theories. Anyway, this has been great, actually, because I actually wouldn't have guessed any of these books. I mean, not that they're not good, they're all good, and they should be read, but I just wouldn't have guessed them, which is great, because people are sick and tired of hearing the same five books I recommend, so I got the master's recommendations, the Mr. Book Review, really, because a lot of these books, I know you could have, books that you review, you could have written yourself, and I remember the first major book that I wrote that was published by Columbia University Press. I still owe you, maybe I sent you a gift at the time, but I probably owe you another gift by now, but I sent the manuscript to you because I was afraid that if I didn't, it would come out and you'd find 27 errors in it. And I thought, you know what? Better just send it to David right off the bat and get his thoughts. And you were so detailed. You pointed out to me that Encyclopedia Britannica spelled encyclopedia with a P-A-E, and I needed to correct that when I referred to my text.
Yes. Well, I recall you. It was a very good book, too, that you wrote. I mean, you know your stuff very well. But, I mean, people do misspell Encyclopedia Britannica. you see that all the time.
But it is so funny to read your reviews and to see the level of detail you go into when you find errors. And I just thought, oh my gosh, there's no hope for Woods then. If I look at the way you would decimate people. So my first thought was always send the manuscript to David. So anyway.
Yes, well, I'm always glad to get your manuscript. I mean, there are people who follow other than you, who follow your strategy. Of course, then I could always have the counter. You know, I do send the comments in the book comment, and now I'll give the real comment.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, I'm grateful for that. And you know, I mean, really, it's been so long since that book. I can't even remember if I sent you a fruit basket or anything. But I don't know. When I see you next, I'll give you something. You're going to get something of some sort for all your good work.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you, Tom. I don't deserve it, but I'll certainly take it.
Yeah, there you go. That is the correct attitude. All right, well, thanks so much for today. These are great, and I know there's going to be a run on these books as a result of this episode. So remember, everybody, check out tomwoods.com/956. And David, thanks again.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, that's going to do it for today, but, I have a podcast to tell you about. A listener has created not only a website, but also a podcast, and you can find the podcast I'm going to tell you about at familypodcasts.com. They also own that domain. It's LCHF Family, and they describe it this way. Many libertarians don't think twice about questioning taxes, foreign policy, or who should build the roads. But don't question the dietary advice issued by governmental agencies. The Frost family, they're the ones who run the podcast, gave up on governmental dietary guidelines a year ago and switched to a low-carb, high-fat diet. Not only did they each lose at least 40 pounds, but they've never felt better. They decided to start a family-friendly podcast to help other families make the transition to LCHF eating. Listen in to learn more about what to expect when you make the switch. Get recipe ideas and share your successes. So familypodcasts.com is where to find this. Scroll down and you will see the link to the LCHF podcast. All right, so get your shout out for your website or blog by checking out all my goodies before you get your hosting. Because you have to get your hosting through my link for this to work. But I have a lot of goodies, including a burst of free publicity. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm a very giving person. Get the details of all these bonuses at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, we had one of our team was out of town this week, so the show was delayed a bit by about a day. So I'm staying true. You know, I have 5 episodes a week. It's still happening. Just, you know, one's coming out on Saturday, that's all. And then a bonus episode on Sunday. It's going to be like a weekend of Woods for you. So watch for those, and I'll talk to you soon.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.